Chapter 19. The Roses. 6 months later. The world was resilient, and so slowly fixed itself. Once the initial thunderstrike of devastation had passed, there was a wave of opportunism, as a certain type of people, that is, the majority, tried to take advantage of what had happened. People who had been sneered at as New Age eco-hippies were now hailed as saviors of humanity, as it dawned on people that their traditional methods of hunting and farming could keep families fed through the winter. Faith healers, evangelists, and witch doctors shook their fists around campfires, and their following blossomed. A million and one other things happened that would change the way humanity lived on the Earth, but possibly the two most important events following the great techno crash were the realization that things could be fixed, and the detection of fairies. After the initial months of panic, a Green Lantern fanatic in Sydney got the internet up and going again, discovering that even though most of the parts in his antenna had exploded, he still knew how to fix it. Slowly, the modern age began to reassert itself, as cell phone networks were rigged by amateurs and kids took over the TV stations. Radios made a huge comeback, and some of the old velvet-voiced guys from the 70s were wheeled out of retirement to slot actual CDs into disk drives. Water became the new gold, and oil dropped a third on the fuel list after solar and wind. Across the globe, there had been hundreds of sightings of strange creatures who might have been fairies or aliens. One moment these creatures were not there, and the next there was a crackle or a bang, and suddenly there were observation posts with little people in them all over the world. Small flying craft fell from the sky, and powerless submarines bobbed to the surface offshore of 100 major cities. The trouble was that all of the machinery self-destructed, and any of the fairies' aliens taken into custody inexplicably vanished in the following weeks. Humanity knew that it was not alone on the planet, but it didn't know where to find these strange creatures, and considering mankind had not even managed to explore the planet's oceans, it would be several hundred years before they developed the capacity to probe beneath the Earth's crust. So the stories were exaggerated until nobody believed them anymore. And the one video that did survive was not half as convincing as any Saturday morning kids' show. People knew what they had seen, and those people would believe it to the day they died. But soon psychiatrists began to assign the fairy sightings to the mass traumatic hallucination scrap heap that was already piled high with dinosaurs, superheroes, and Loch Ness monsters. The Fowl Estate. Ireland became truly an island once more. Communities retreated into themselves and began growing foodstuffs that they would actually eat rather than mechanically suck all the goodness out of, freeze all the additives into, and ship off to other continents. Many wealthy landowners voluntarily donated their idle fields to disgruntled, hungry people with sharp implements. Artemis's parents had managed to make their way home from London, where they had been when the world broke down. And shortly after the funeral ceremony for Artemis, the Fowl Estate was converted into over 500 separate plots, where people could grow whatever fruit and vegetables the Irish climate permitted. The ceremony itself was simple and private, with only the Fowl and Butler families present. Artemis's body was buried on the high meadow, where he had spent so much of his time tinkering on his solar plane. Butler did not attend, because he steadfastly refused to believe the evidence presented to him by his own eyes. "Artemis has not gone," he asserted, time after time. "This is not the end game." He would not be persuaded otherwise, no matter how many times Juliet or Angeline Fowle dropped down to his dojo for a talk, which was why the bodyguard showed not one whit of surprise when Captain Holly Short appeared at the door of his lodge at dawn one morning. "Well, it's about time," he said, grabbing his jacket from the coat rack. "Artemis leaves instructions, and it takes you guys half a year to figure them out." Holly hurried after him. Artemis's instructions were not exactly simple to follow, and typically they were totally illegal. In the courtyard, a doorway had been cut into the orange glow of the morning sky, and in that doorway stood Foley, looking decidedly nervous. "Which do you think seems less suspicious?" asked Butler. An alien-looking craft hovering in the yard of a country home? Or a floating doorway with a centaur standing in it? Foley clopped down the gangplank, towing a hover trolley behind him. The shuttle door closed and fizzled out of the visible spectrum. "Can we get on with this, please?" he wondered. "Everything we're doing here is against fairy law and possibly immoral. Cabaline thinks I'm at Mulch's ceremony. The council is actually giving him a medal. I hate lying to my wife. If I stop to think about this for more than 10 seconds, I might just change my mind." Holly took control of the hover trolley. "You will not change your mind. We have come too far just to go home without a result." "Hey," said Foley, "I was just saying." Holly's eyes were hard with a determination that would tolerate no argument. She had been wearing that expression every day now for 6 months, ever since she had returned home from the Berserker Gate incident. The first thing she had done was seek out Foley in Police Plaza. "I have a message for you from Artemis," she'd said, once Foley had released her from a smothering hug. "Really? What did he say?" "He said something about a chrysalis. You were to power it up." These words had a powerful effect on the centaur. He trotted to the door and locked it behind Holly. Then he ran a bug sweep with a wand he kept on his person. Holly knew then that the word meant something to her friend. "What chrysalis, Foley, and why is Artemis so interested in it?" Foley took Holly's shoulders and placed her in a lab chair. "Why is Artemis interested? Our friend is dead, Holly. Maybe we should let him go." Holly pushed Foley away and jumped to her feet. "Let him go? Artemis didn't let me go in limbo. He didn't let Butler go in London. He didn't let the entire city of Haven go during the Goblin Revolution. Now tell me, what is this chrysalis?" So Foley told her, and the bones of Artemis's idea became obvious. But more information was needed. "Was there anything else?" asked the centaur. "Did Artemis say or do anything else?" Holly shook her head miserably. "No. He got a little sentimental, which is unusual for him, but understandable. He told me to kiss you." She stood on tiptoes and kissed Foley's forehead. "Just in case, I suppose." Foley was suddenly upset and almost overwhelmed, but he coughed and swallowed it down for another time. "He said, 'Kiss Foley?' Those exact words?" "No," said Holly, thinking back. "He kissed me and said, 'Give him that from me.'" The centaur grinned, then cackled, then dragged her across the lab. "We need to get your forehead under an electron microscope," he said. Holly explained their interpretation of Artemis's plan to Butler as they walked toward the Berserker Gate. Foley trotted ahead, muttering calculations to himself and keeping an eye out for early bird humans. The chrysalis was what Opal used to grow a clone of herself. It was turned over to Foley, who was supposed to destroy it. "But he didn't," guessed Butler. "No, and Artemis knew that from hacking into LEP recycling records." "So Artemis wanted Foley to grow a clone? Even an old soldier like me knows that you need DNA for that." Holly tapped her forehead. "That's why he kissed me. There was enough DNA in the saliva for Foley to grow an army. But it seemed like a natural trace to the airport scanners." "A genius to the end," said Butler. He frowned. "But aren't clones poor, dumb creatures? Nopal could barely stay alive." Foley stopped at the lip of the crater to explain. "Yes, they are. Because they don't have a soul. This is where the magic comes in. When the first Berserker lock was closed, all fairy spirits within the magic circle were released from their bodies. But Artemis may have had enough human in him, and enough sheer willpower to remain in this realm, even after his physical body died. His spirit could be a free-floating, ectoplasmic, ethereal organism right now." Butler almost stumbled over his own feet. "Are you saying Artemis as a ghost?" He turned to Holly for a straight answer. "Is he actually saying that Artemis as a ghost?" Holly steered the hover trolley down the incline. "The Berserkers were ghosts for 10,000 years. That's how the spell worked. If they lasted that long, it's possible that Artemis held on for 6 months." "Possible," said Butler. "That's all we've got?" Foley pointed to a spot near the tower. Possible is being optimistic. I would say barely conceivable would be a better bet. Holly undid the clips of a refrigerated container on top of the hover trolley. Yes, well, the barely conceivable is Artemis Fowl's specialty. Butler heaved off the lid, and what he saw inside took his breath away. Even though he had been expecting it, Artemis's clone lay inside a transparent tent, breath fogging the plastic. Artemis, he said. It's him, exactly. I had to play with a hot housing, said Foley, unhooking the clone from its life support systems, and I didn't have access to my own lab, so he has six toes on his left foot now. But it's close enough for a backstreet job. I never thought I'd say it, but Opal Cowboy made good tech. He's 15 now, right? Foley ducked behind a twist of nutrient pipes to hide his face. Actually, the timing got away from me a little, so he's a little older. But don't worry, I gave him a total makeover. Skin shrink, bone scrape, marrow injections. I even lubed his brain. Believe me, his own mother wouldn't be able to tell the difference. He rubbed his hands and changed the subject. Now, to work. Show me where Artemis died. Down there, said Holly, pointing. By the... She had been about to say tower, but her breath caught in her throat at the sight of the incredible roses that grew in thick, curved bands, emanating from the exact point where Artemis had collapsed. The Fowl Estate roses were something of a sensation, blooming as they did in a perfect spiral at the foot of the round tower, where no roses had been planted. Their unusual burnished orange petals made them visible from the other garden plots, and Juliet had been assigned to the task of ensuring that none of the villagers helped themselves to as much as a single stem. Because of recent Little People rumours, the garden workers had taken to calling the flowers fairy roses, which was a better name for them than even they suspected. Butler carried the enclosed clone in his arms, and he was suddenly reminded of a night years ago when he had carried someone else through a field, watching the tall grass swish in Artemis's wake. Except that time I was carrying Holly. Foley interrupted his thought. Butler, you must place the body in the roses, at the center of the spiral. Without life support, we only have minutes before degeneration begins. Butler laid the clone gently inside the spiral, on a soft patch, where there were no thorns to pierce it. Holly knelt to open the tent's zipper. She pulled the flaps apart, and inside lay Artemis's new body, in a hospital gown, its breath coming in short gasps, sweat sheening its forehead. Foley moved quickly around the clone, straightening its limbs, tilting its head back to clear the airways. These roses, he said, they are a sign. There's magical residue here. I would bet this formation is pretty much the same shape as Bruinfader's original rune. You're pinning your hopes on a flower bed sprouting in the meadow. No, of course not, Butler. Bruinfader's magic was powerful, and someone with Artemis's willpower could easily last a few months. Butler held his own skull. What if this doesn't work, Holly? What if I let Artemis die? Holly turned quickly and saw that Butler was emotionally stretched. He had been hiding behind denial for half a year and would blame himself forever if Artemis didn't come back. If this does not work, Butler may never recover, she realized. It will work, she said. Now, less talk and more resurrecting. How long do we have, Foley? The clone can survive for perhaps 15 minutes away from the life support. Butler knew that the time for objections was past. He would do whatever was necessary to give this plan a chance to succeed. Very well, Holly, he said, standing to attention. What should I do? Holly squatted 3 feet from the clone, fingers wrapped around rose stems, oblivious to the thorns piercing her skin. It is all done now. Either he appears, or we have lost him forever. I think we will have lost something of ourselves, too, thought Butler. They waited, and nothing out of the ordinary happened. Birds sang, the hedgerow bustled, and the sound of a tractor engine drifted to them across the fields. Holly squatted and fretted, dragging flowers out by their roots. While she worried, Butler's gaze rested on the clone's face, and he recalled times past spent with his principal. There never was anyone like Artemis Fowl, he thought. Though he didn't make my job any easier with all his shenanigans. Butler smiled. Artemis always had my back, even though he could barely reach it. Holly, he said gently, he's not coming. Then the wind changed, and suddenly Butler could smell the roses. Holly stumbled forward to her feet.
So something's happening. I think something is happening.
The breeze scooped a few rose petals from the flowers and sent them spinning skyward. More and more petals broke free as the wind seemed to curve along the orange spiral, quickly stripping each flower. The petals rose like butterflies, flitting and shimmering, filling the sky, blocking the sun.
Artemis, Butler called, come to my voice.
Has he done it? Is this Artemis Fowl's greatest moment?
The petals swirled with a noise like a chorus of sighs, and then suddenly dropped, like stones. The clone had not moved. Holly moved forward slowly, as though learning to use her legs, then dropped to her knees, clasping the clone's hand.
Artemis, she said, the word like a prayer. Artemis, please.
Still nothing. Not even breath now. Butler had no time for his usual impeccable manners, and moved Holly aside.
Sorry, Captain. This is my area of expertise.
He knelt over the pale clone, and with his palm searched for a heartbeat. There was none. Butler tilted the clone's head back, pinched its nose, and breathed life deep into its lungs. He felt a weak heartbeat under his hand.
Butler fell backward. Holly! I think it worked.
Holly crawled through the carpet of petals.
Artemis! She said urgently. Artemis, come back to us!
Two more breaths passed, then several rapid, jerky ones. Then Artemis's eyes opened, both a startling blue. The eyes were initially wide with shock, then fluttered like the wings of a jarred moth.
Be calm, said Holly. You are safe now.
Artemis frowned, trying to focus. It was clear that his faculties had not totally returned, and he did not yet remember the people leaning over him.
Stay back, he said. You don't know what you're dealing with.
Holly took his hand.
We do know you, Artemis, and you know us. Try to remember.
Artemis did try, concentrating until some of the clouds lifted.
You, he said hesitantly. You are my friends. Holly wept with sheer relief. Yes, she said, we are your friends. Now we need to get you inside before the locals arrive and see the recently deceased heir being escorted by fairies.
Butler helped Artemis to his feet, on which he was obviously unsteady.
Oh, go on then, said Foley, offering his broad back. Just this once.
Butler lifted Artemis onto the centaur's back and steadied him with a huge hand.
You had me worried, Artie, he said, and your parents are devastated. Wait until they see you.
As they walked across the fields, Holly pointed out areas of shared experience, hoping to jog the teen's memory.
Tell me,
Artemis said, his voice still weak.
How do I know you?
And so Holly began her story. It all started in Ho Chi Minh City one summer. It was sweltering by anyone's standards. Needless to say, Artemis Fowl would not have been willing to put up with such discomfort if something extremely important had not been at stake. Important to the plan.